Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 8th of April. The House I Live In airs on PBS tonight, 9 o'clock tonight on Wisconsin Public Television and 10 o'clock on Milwaukee Public Television. Make sure you check your local listings around the state for the exact time, but we've researched this, and this is, as far as we can tell, the times that it will be on. It is the extremely well-documented story. I had a chance to view this over the weekend, of not only the damage that drugs do to people, but how that has been made far worse by the laws that America has enacted to stop them. And these laws go back quite a number of years. Our guest, Eugene Jarecki, the writer, director, and producer of the story, interviewed people all over the country, and he interviewed many, many people whose families had been pulled into a vicious cycle of drugs and the criminal justice system. He spoke with dealers, users, family members, police, wardens, judges, medical experts, and many others to launch what is called a war that is against its own people. The statistics are phenomenal. Some of the interviews are really, really thought-provoking. He looks at three strikes, you're out, the monetary interest in drug arrests, profiling for drug use, which is supposed to be illegal, the history of drug use in this country going way back to the 1800s, a fascinating interview, the use of meth, and who's using that. Some suggesting that we've been trying to get rid of the bottom 15% of our society, killing the poor in this way for a number of years. So we have a lot to talk about with our guest, and I think that many of you might want to call, too. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Eugene has done a number of other films. Reagan, which was on HBO for the former president's 100th birthday, a documentary inspired by the best-selling book Freakonomics, another Move Your Money, also Why We Fight, and a subsequent book, The American Way of War, Guided Missiles, Misguided Men, A Republic in Peril, to name just a few of his other works. Eugene, thank you so much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah. Your documentary was absolutely fascinating to me because I don't know where you found some of these people, but some of the thoughts about this I had just never heard expressed before. You went everywhere for this, didn't you?
I did. We filmed the movie in about 25 U.S. states. It was a huge undertaking, but what I wanted to make sure I did, you know, a lot of your listeners may be familiar with the television show The Wire, created by David Simon. And mm-hmm. David Simon's actually in my movie, and he's an amazing contributor. His show The Wire is about Baltimore, and it's very true to the drug war as it unfolds in Baltimore. And I just wanted to make sure that if I was going to do a documentary on this subject, that people would leave it without any risk that they would say, oh, well, he just did that about Chicago, or mm-hmm. that's just New York, or that's... I wanted to show them that the drug war has become an epidemic that affects every corner of this country, whether rural, urban, white, black. I was about to say poor or rich, but that would not have been true, because it targets poor people of all types and middle-class people all over this country in a way that is running out of control.
So it's a class issue in some ways.
It's entirely become a class issue. Now, it started as racism. I mean, you can say pure and simple that we have drug laws in this country. The first ones we see are in the 1800s, and they are overtly laws against Chinese people. These were the famous opium laws. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know what they were when I started making the film. And as it turns out, at that time, in the mid-1800s, it was feared that Chinese people were coming over to this country and would be taking American jobs, primarily in California, building railroads and so forth. Well, you couldn't pass a law. People were worried locally. But you couldn't pass a law that said it was illegal to be Chinese. But you could pass a law that would address some habit that the Chinese have that special to them, that you could then sort of use as a reason to stop and harass them. And so we passed opium laws. Now, the amazing thing is, it passed is so much prelude. It tells us so much about how we do this today. We didn't pass opium laws all over the country. We didn't make opium illegal in America. We only made it illegal in California. Hmm. And interestingly, at that time, the number one user of opium in America was a middle-aged white woman, usually in the South. And we didn't make using opium illegal in California. We only made smoking opium illegal in California because that was the particular technique that the Chinese used. Now, that was the first racist move where you saw a drug law really being a thinly veiled law of racial control. We've had several more leading up to the present. And over time, that racism has given way, and we can talk about it, to a very fundamental classism in how we implement this.
That particular interview with Richard Lawrence Miller, the American historian, was absolutely fascinating because he went on and talked about, made comparisons almost to the Holocaust, that we're ostracizing people, we learn to hate them, we separate people in ghettos, we confiscate their possessions, and we concentrate them. And
you know, today is Holocaust Remembrance Day, and I'm a Jewish person whose father fled Nazi Germany in 1939. I lost family to the Holocaust, and my mother's family fled the Tsars of Russia in the turn of the 20th century. So in many ways, a day like today is a day that deeply makes me consider any region in the world in which man's inhumanity to man is on display, in which we are singling out a group of people, targeting them as a kind of source of society's ills, whether they are or they're not, then passing new laws whereby we can stop them on the street, pat them down, search for something. In the case of the Jews in the 1930s, you could be asked for your ID, where yesterday you didn't have to show any ID. Now suddenly there's a new law and you do. And the next thing that happens is you start confiscating those people and their property. And once you do that, you start concentrating those people into facilities. Now, all of this is very clearly what we saw in the Holocaust, and it led, of course, to the next terrible step called annihilation. What Richard Lawrence Miller does in the film is he says, look, if we are to take never again seriously, we are to look at any society in the world that takes any of these steps, that isolates a group of people and pretends they're the problem, that changes the laws so they can be treated differently and be unequal under the law, that we can confiscate them and concentrate them into facilities in disproportion. Well, we've done that in poor communities in America, especially black communities. Black people are nine times as likely to be arrested on the streets of New York today than white people, even though they use drugs at the same rate.
Let's talk about, because there's some very moving segments, and they are in black areas, they're in ghettos, with young people you interview, and you interview their fathers when they're around. A lot of the young people don't have fathers, but the economic circumstances are such, they're so dire, that as one of the people in the film said, it's Christmas time when the drug dealer arrives on the street, because you get some presents and you get ice cream, and there's just no path to make a living for yourself, and these people are making your life a little happier.
Right. I mean, I think the constant refrain that I hear from sort of people who haven't given the matter a lot of thought, but they've seen what's on TV or they've read what's in the papers is, oh, it's a thing of personal responsibility. Drug use is something people just get involved in and they're being irresponsible. Well, most often people get involved when they're a child, when we already assume they're not responsible. We wouldn't let them drive a car. Yet, by the way, we're happy to put them away in jail as if they're an adult, but we don't even let them go to certain movies. But jail is okay. So already this whole concept of assuming that a young person is supposed to demonstrate personal responsibility beyond their years is an inappropriate expectation. But let's go further. Because what's really happening to that young person in this country is that they're growing up in communities that for many reasons having to do with this country's abandonment of her poor and working classes, which we've watched happen over the decades of sort of corporations being enthroned in this country and wealth being idealized as sort of the greatest goal in America rather than equality and depth and democracy, I would say. Well, these young people grow up in communities that have been forsaken. They have bad infrastructure, failing schools, no health care. The churches are not primary. There is no town hall. I've been in 45 states in this country in the last year. Everywhere I go, you see the horrible scars of a strip-malled country where instead of town centers, instead of a park in the middle where kids can congregate, they're sort of huddling outside the front door of a Walmart skateboarding. That's not a country. That's a corporation. And so the result of that is that these young people are aimless. They're leaderless. In many senses, they're meaningless. And they then self-medicate. For some reason, they don't even understand at age 13. But before long, they get caught for it, and now they have a strike on their record that they will never lose, and it will prevent them forever from being part of the mainstream society, getting a job in a conventional economy. So what will they do? They'll turn to an underground economy that will accept them. So now the drug dealer will become a father figure to them, mm-hmm. and he'll teach them the ways of the street, he'll teach them how to do it, and they'll go down that road, and we'll then say, where's their personal responsibility? Well, where is our responsibility for running a society that lives up to the promise of our Constitution? That is failing, and so I have this terrible notion that I hear from people where they look to the personal responsibility part, and so it's for that reason that I went into the inner city and talked to the father of one of the jailed young drug offenders who I had. This kid would strike you like, you know, a friend of your child at school, and
yes,
he's wasting away in a prison in upstate New York. And when I went to talk to his father said, well, I was the same way. I was a loser on the street. I didn't know anything. And there were a couple of slightly more powerful people. And to me, they were like Santa Claus. When they came around, they'd give my mom money for groceries. They'd buy me sneakers. They'd get me ice cream. In a world where nobody else did anything like that, the society had given up on me. They hadn't. So they become my father figure. And then before long, I'm dealing. I don't even know what I'm doing. Then I start using. Now I start dealing to pay for my habit. And just listening, it's so heartbreaking. And you see these people trapped in, now they're going to be called a deadbeat dad. Well, then they never even had a chance to be a child.
I know.
Of course they became a deadbeat dad.
It is heartbreaking, Eugene. It is just so heartbreaking. And it's not just in those communities. You also talk about the meth, and that's in areas like Nebraska and Oklahoma, et cetera. Poor white people who, when the economy really went south, had to find a way to make a living, and a lot of them went to meth, right? And now they're in those prisons.
You asked earlier about the racism and the classism. What's happened is that there were drug laws all through time that were racist. Okay, we get that. Then came Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon in 1971 declared a war on drugs. That was a whole other thing that federalized it, and it made crime into a national issue, really for the first time, electorally. Well, the interesting thing is, even though Nixon talked tough on drugs, he actually was very progressive, far more progressive, for example, than Barack Obama. Richard Nixon spent two-thirds of his entire drug budget on drug treatment rather than on law enforcement. That was a small part of what he spent his money on. Yet he knew that on the campaign trail, talking tough won votes.
Right.
So the horrible thing you can say about Nixon is that he knew better, and he was doing better, and he nonetheless coined all of the language of some of the most tough-on-crime rhetoric, and we've been living with it ever since, with politician after politician trying to fit the Nixon mold. Well, where that's led us is an out-of-control war. And a war brings with it something that the previous ad hoc racist drug laws didn't, which is it unleashed the dogs of war, the dogs of corporations, the dogs of unions, the dogs of private pressure groups that come to rely on the continuation of the war. So now that we know the war is a failure, you have to ask yourself, this has been going on for 40 years. We've spent $1 trillion. We've had 45 million drug arrests. And we have nothing to show for it except the record of abject failure. Drugs are cheaper, purer, more available than ever before, and younger people are using them. We have the highest prison population in the world and the highest levels of drug demand in the world, undeterred. So how could we keep doing this after such a record of failure? Well, the same way we stay in many wars that are failures, because vested interests won't let the war end. And the prison industrial complex in this country is a product of the war on drugs.
And you mention in some parts of the film, I think it was Oklahoma or maybe someplace else, if the prison left town, all the employment would go. It's become a huge industry. Talk about how huge it is.
Yes, and that industry has a voracious appetite. I mean, understand it this way. We're not just talking about the ghouls at the top who own major prison contracting companies who, you know, literally trade in human beings. They make their money from the incarceration of their fellow human beings. So we have those monsters, and they are people who should not be doing for a living what they're doing, and somewhere in their hearts they know it. But we're talking about everybody else. We're just ordinary people just getting a job. They're a prison guard. They're not a hurtful person. They're just there trying to have a job in an almost jobless economy. So there's so many jobs reliant on this that politicians seek to bring more jobs to the district to curry favor with voters. They want to give corporations what they want because they need the money from those corporations. So our legislators, day after day, go into work and they write laws that fill more beds in more prisons for more time. That's what they do. and the result is that the prison industrial complex looks smilingly on them. Now, that voracious appetite that the machine has developed explains why it moved from race to class, because black people only represent 14% of the country, and they've spent 40 years being the disproportionate target of the drug war to an extraordinary degree. Mm-hmm. You know, black people, it turns out, you may not know this, and I didn't. I always thought crack was a black drug.
Right.
No, turns out crack is a white drug. The majority of crack users in America have always been white. Mm. Black people are 14% of the country, and they're 14% of the crack users. So astonishingly, the propaganda is so thick surrounding all this that we barely know what to think. But what we do know is that the drug war sort of looked at this 14% minority, and the machinery of it at one point said, what are we limiting ourselves to 14% of the country? There's plenty of people out there we can jail. And that's exactly at the same time that increasing poverty in America across the racial spectrum started to make more and more poor whites. And those poor whites started finding their way to methamphetamine and the same cycle of despair and meaninglessness that black people had been experiencing for decades. And so you're watching a democratization, racially, of the drug war, but the unifying force now is poverty. Yeah. Poverty is what you dominantly see in why people use drugs, why there are cops in their neighborhood rather than in my comfortable neighborhood, mm-hmm. why when they get to the courthouse they don't get a good lawyer because they don't have the money for one,
right.
and then why they fall prey to incredible and exorbitant sentencing, which is specially designed to hurt poor people and let comfortable people use drugs in privacy without disturbance.
Yeah. Eugene, let's talk, because I wonder what the update is. You look extensively in the documentary about disparity in sentencing with cocaine use and crack cocaine use. Has that changed now? Is there less disparity?
We watched for 30 years a situation grip the country that I found astonishing, and I think most people don't know about it. People should know that historically, crack cocaine, which is the same chemical as powder cocaine, it's actually just a diluted form of powder because you add baking soda and water and heat to it to get crack out of powder. Crack cocaine was historically punished 100 times more severely than powder cocaine. So if I'm walking down the street with 5 grams of crack cocaine and you are walking down the street with powder cocaine, you need 500 grams of it on you to get the same sentence I'm going to get for my 5 little grams. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, my 5 little grams have a tiny street value. 500 grams of powder cocaine has a huge street value. So a much bigger crime gets the same offense. Well, since we know that those who were being arrested and charged with crack offenses historically were black, you know, 14% of the country uses 14% of the country is black, and they are the crack. That is the crack using that they do. 90% of those charged with crack offenses are black. So this disproportion was so significant that over the years, people started to come to the Congress and say, this is having an insane effect. Why are so many black people going away? And the Sentencing Commission, which was asked to look at this by Congress, said it's the 100-to-1 ratio because basically, black people are the ones getting nabbed for crack, even though they're not the majority user, as we pointed out, but they're the ones being policed for crack, so that when they then come to the courthouse, having already been racially preselected, they then get 100 times the penalty that a white person would get. And so we have this extraordinary explosion of the prison population since 1971. It's gone up 700%.
Oh, my.
And the vast 700% increase in 71. And the vast percentage of that are black Americans. And that happened because of the crack laws. Now, yes, in the last 2 years, the Obama administration, with some support from Congress, passed a change in the law, and many of us awaited it expectantly, and were only deflated because they didn't change it from 100-to-1 to 1-to-1, which is what it should be since crack and powder are the same drug. If anything, maybe crack should have a lesser sentence because it's a diluted form of powder. No, they made it 18-to-1.
Hmm.
Arbitrarily, nobody can figure out why, after decades of damaging humans, their families, communities, under a law that has no science in it and no common sense, they decided to simply make it a different version of a senseless and unscientific law.
We have many people who want to join the conversation, and we'll invite them to do so in a moment. Tonight on PBS, The House I Live In, Eugene Jarecki is the director and the writer of this important documentary. It's really well done. I've seen it, and I, you know, sometimes recommend things because I think you'll find it pretty riveting, because it is. And it raises a number of profound questions. It will be on Wisconsin Public Television tonight at 9, Milwaukee Public Television tonight at 10. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@WPR.org, Facebook page is the Kathleen Dent Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The House I Live In, a film by Eugene Jarecki, airing tonight. It was the Grand Jury Prize documentary winner for the 2012 Sundance Film Festival. Tonight it is on PBS, and it is well worth your time. It is extremely well-researched, and I'll use the word again, but it's very provocative. Let's go to phone calls for Eugene. Rich in Rhinelander is first. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Eugene.
Hi, Rich.
First of all, I can't think of a better way to observe or commemorate Holocaust Memorial than by talking about your film and also about this issue. The Northwoods Unitarian Universalist Fellowship up here book group read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, which is about the drug war. We met recently and we discussed it. People were overwhelmed by the message in the book, and that's what we want to overcome, is being overwhelmed. We're in the process of talking about what well-intentioned people can do in order to make a difference with regard to this topic. And we were trying to figure out, ironically, how to get a screening of your film. And we don't have to worry about that anymore. We do believe in education. Yes. And we think we would start there with education. But many of the educators in the book group were almost in tears because they talked about during their years in teaching that they had supported the war on drugs, thinking it was a value to kids to stay away from drugs, which is true. But now we're looking for suggestions that either we come up with or perhaps you can provide about what can we do in order to make a difference.
Thank you, Rich. Thanks, Rich.
Let me suggest two things. First of all, thank you for all of those thoughts. And yes, we do make the film available to groups educationally. We go around the country sort of tirelessly showing it in towns and cities across the country. And you can go to our website, which is the title of the film, thehouseilivein.org. And there's a place where you can ask if you want to have a screening, and we'll help arrange it for you, or you can just email us with any manner of inquiry. The other thing you can do on our website is to begin to answer this question about what you can do. And the reason I say that is I launched several years ago the video called Move Your Money, which caused a lot of Americans to take their money out of the major banks in protest of the bad practices of those too big to fail banks. We did that very successfully, and part of what was successful is we set up a website where people could go and enter their zip code to learn where there was a good bank or local bank, community bank, or credit union near them to move their money to. That was very successful. We do the same with thehouseilivein.org. You can go there and enter your zip code, and you'll learn what's going on in the drug war in your area. What are the key issues, for example, in Wisconsin or elsewhere that you're concerned about? And by entering that zip code, it'll tell you not only what's going on, what the key issues are in the area, but who's fighting against them. Is the ACLU active locally? Is the Drug Policy Alliance, Families Against Mandatory Minimums, one group or another? And they, I can assure you, have lots of views for interested people who care to become boots on the ground in efforts they make to make legislative change. And I have to tell you, a lot of these groups are very effective. Colorado changed its law in November to legalize marijuana. That was due to tireless effort on the ground. Washington did the same in November. That was boots on the ground. California changed its three strikes law in November. That was boots on the ground. I know that because in all of those places, we actively used the film, and we actively joined forces with groups on the ground to make those laws change. It's happening all the time. I'm in Sacramento right now, where today I'm going to be speaking to the California legislature who tomorrow is going to vote on a bill that will impact 21,000 California inmates who were sentenced as juveniles. If they've had a decade of good behavior, this new bill would make it that their sentences would be revisited. Well, that's a huge measure of justice in just one place, and just everyday people on the ground fighting for this. And the movie is being used by those groups, and we always make it available. But that's something any of your listeners can do, is go on our website, thehouseilivein.org, find the place where you can enter your zip code, and it's very obvious, and it'll tell you what's going on in your area and give you the first steps toward getting actively involved with those doing the work.
Mm. How did you become such an activist in so many areas? I mean, a successful one, I might add, as well.
Well, I was born comfortable. You know, I was born without, I wasn't hungry. My parents were not racist. I had a very open home that was the home of people who'd already suffered persecution in their lives. And so we were taught as children, my brothers and I as all boys, we were taught that our lives would only make sense if we were really committed to social justice for those who were voiceless as we had been. And so, for example, the Black American struggle in America was a natural sort of sister struggle to our own in the eyes of my parents and a lot of Jews at that time. And so as I was growing up in the early 1970s, for example, I saw, you know, I was expecting major gains for Black people after the Civil Rights Movement. I was a kid, but that was the primary sort of that was the primary romanticism I had, was that I was a young person living at times of serious America living up to her promise. And then I saw that Black people weren't achieving those gains. I mean, sure, we have a Black president, and we have famous Black celebrities who make a huge contribution. But for the masses of Black people, for decades now, the leading indicators have been grim, nothing short of that. And so the question was, why? What has been blocking Black progress? And so my own activism in many ways in my whole life started with a concern for Black America, but I then made films about a whole range of subjects that really have to do with how the wealthy and powerful exploit everybody else in this global society run by America. I mean, I see that theme in all my movies, because I think we're all living in a world where we thought this was a country that is first and foremost a democracy. And if you were to land on this country from Mars today, you would see a country that looks first and foremost to be a kind of unchecked capitalist country, secondarily a democracy. Primarily, we are run by money and corporations. They have our politicians in their pocket, which is why in every walk of American life, you see horrendous decisions being made that put profit before people and principle. My movies are all about that. The prison industrial complex of this film is just maybe the most brazen example of literally feeding human beings into a machine and having money pop out the other end.
Mm. An email from Dave in Menominee. Can you address the cost in dollars of what we spend per pupil compared to what we spend per prisoner in our country? And how does the privatization of the prison industry affect this problem?
You know, I would have made my film about the depravity of our system of industrialized mass incarceration. I mean, that's what we have. The war on drugs created one of our largest industries, which is an industry of incarcerating our fellow human beings. Imagine. It's almost on par with making casinos in every city in your country. You're not making anything new. You're just cannibalizing you're cannibalizing the savings of your own people. In the prison industrial system, you're cannibalizing their bodies and their homes and their families. That industry is so vast, and everyone says, oh, it's disgusting, the private prison system. And I said, whoa. I would have made my film, The House I Live In, if we didn't even have a private system. The public system in America is already a grotesque shame in the eyes of the world. Before you even get to the idea that there are major prison corporations, we already live in a country that has politicians talking tough on crime rhetoric so they can get elected. That rhetoric is serviceable to a wide range of corporations that service the public prison system before we even get into private prisons. That unholy alliance is one in which the policymaker, you know, what does a legislator do? They come to work knowing that they've got to please the corporation or the union that's funding them. So if it's a prison guard union, or it's a bunch of companies that provide phone services to prisons or construction services or any of the lot, what do? They come in and write legislation that makes things into crimes that didn't used to be, so more people can get picked up for them. and then makes the sentencing more and more draconian so that the people will go into jail for longer and longer. So the idea is get bodies into these cells for longer so that these set of interests can profit from them.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing. They may say, oh, drugs are a problem, isn't it terrible, and they may bite their upper lip, and oh, it's all so sad. That's not really what they're doing. If they were doing that, they would endorse treatment, which all science and medicine tells us is the only thing that works. Drug addiction is a public health matter, and we treated it incorrectly as a crime. That's on a national level. I mean, we talked a moment ago about finding out what's going on in your state. On a national level, we need to throw the drug war on the ash heap of history. The Obama administration won't even call it a drug war anymore because it's so embarrassing to have launched a war against your own people when they are most afflicted. We are the most addicted country on earth. That means we have the majority population of addicts. We are therefore most afflicted. And instead of treating it, we treat it as a crime. Now, what happened? It got worse and worse. We are more addicted than ever. What does that mean? Well, if you look south of the border and you see Mexico collapsing, Mexico is collapsing because we made drugs a crime. Simple. By making them a crime, the price stays high, high enough that it's worth killing each other for. Take the business out of it, i.e. make it a public health matter and not a crime, the price will drop, the business will go away, and that violence will migrate to where we can isolate it as just money-driven violence, rather than the confusion we have now, which is the mass incarceration of the nonviolent. Most people who get arrested in this country for drugs are nonviolent, and we are putting them in jail for sentences equal to or often longer than the violent.
Mm. So if that all disappeared, we would still have to figure out a way to get more money to poor people so they could live all right, right? That still remains
a
problem.
I'll tell you what it is. It's actually very good news. The country of Portugal leads the world right now as a shining light in all of this. Very few people even know anything about Portugal. Well, Portugal had a huge drug problem about a dozen years ago. 10 years ago, they changed their laws entirely and legalized drugs across the board in possession. So all possession of all drugs across the board was decriminalized a decade ago in Portugal. Unless you have such a huge amount that you're clearly a dealer, then they have serious penalties that are associated with that. But beneath that, everybody got decriminalized. What was the result? A stunning success. Drug use rates are down, particularly among the young. HIV rates are down. Violence is down, and the workload of the criminal justice system has plummeted. Now, that's obviously provided Portugal with a huge economic savings because it's so expensive to put people in jail and keep them in jail and the rest. So they took just a fraction of that savings and used it to establish the most robust and innovative treatment system in the world, and the results have been overwhelmingly positive.
Fascinating. And
America can no longer hide from examples like that show us the lie of our tough-on-crime approach.
Well, you have to have economic opportunity, right, Eugene? I mean, there are some people who get out of prison, and where in the world are they going to go? The rehab programs aren't there anymore. They don't have any skills. And what are you going to do? So what did Portugal do to create another economy for people who used to deal in drugs?
I think what they did, well, first of all, understand that in America, if you were to start to dismantle the extraordinary excess of our commitment to prison industrialization, that's a lot of jobs, but they'll migrate. They'll migrate into treatment. It's not like you can then shift to treatment and there's no jobs in treatment. A guy who's a prison guard today is somebody working in a treatment center tomorrow just without the punitive aspect.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that these people all go jobless. They migrate. And in fact, when I speak to audiences of prison guards and others that I'm very close to, I'm reminding them you would migrate to a job that you'd be proud to tell your kid about.
Yeah, exactly. That's
right?
A very good
I went
point.
To a prison in Oklahoma on Bring Your Kid to Work Day. I just happen to have been there on Bring Your Kid to Work Day. Nobody brought their kid to work. Would you bring your kid to your job at the prison?
Probably
but you probably not. Would bring your kid to a job at a hospital.
Right.
In fact, when you go to a hospital and bring your kid to work day, they're all getting lollipops or putting finger paint on the walls. That's what you want. So this would be a positive migration for the country in terms of jobs, and in terms of those who are now being given treatment, sure, one of the things that everyone is going to take away from those treatment meetings is there's no other game in town. There's no other options out there. Sure, that will mean that America could take some of the $1 trillion we've wasted over the last 40 years, the $50 billion we spend a year, and put it into some programs that'll create some opportunity, and you might just have more innovation on your hands. You might actually have a stronger workforce. You might be able to compete in the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we're doing right now, if you realize how many Americans use drugs, and if you also realize how many of our most famous contributing Americans, you know, like Steve Jobs, I mean, I'm talking to you right now on an iPhone, created by a man who used drugs. So who knows whether wasting away in one of our jails somewhere is the next great innovator who's there because he was in the wrong zip code, because he had the wrong skin color, because he was poor in a way that somebody else wasn't. So what a terrible waste we're involved in squandering our population and demonstrating that we don't believe in Christian compassion. We believe in the economics of punishment.
Let's go to Kelly in River Falls. Hi, Kelly.
Well, I feel so lucky to live in a country where we've got public television and public radio. Thank you for all your work unearthing this subject. On the subject of drugs, you know, we've got legal drugs like alcohol, and we use all kinds of barbiturates and things legally under doctor's care. Then we've got other drugs, marijuana, heroin, like you mentioned, opium before, which are illegal. I'm just wondering, I'm thinking more along the lines of like the methamphetamine. I've had people very close to me involved with meth and watched them devastated. I've seen some folks never recover, and I've seen other folks who have been off for a number of years. And I just wonder if you could speak to the not all drugs are created equal, and where you stand on that. And just thank you so much. This is such a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Thank you, Kelly.
It's a great question, and it brings us into two areas we need to think about. One is, let's look at the insane hypocrisy of it. We already did this. We had prohibition. It blew up in our face. It was a disaster. We scrambled for a new idea, and we came up with the system we have in place for alcohol, where it is a controlled substance. The government taxes and regulates it. You cannot sell it to a child. That's illegal. A grown-up can use it but has to use it responsibly. And if you take your car out and hit somebody with it and kill them, it's going to be manslaughter. If it turns out you were drinking, that's going to aggravate the offense. Okay, that's a controlled substance. Not a perfect system because America has insufficient alcohol treatment for people, but pretty good compared to the disaster of the war on drugs. But why is it that we took all of the drugs on the schedule of illegal drugs, not one of which has the track record of addiction, health destruction, or public safety threat as alcohol, and we treat them more severely than alcohol? Who can possibly argue for this? Not one of them competes in terms of public danger, and they are punished as illegal when the other form of self-soothing, alcohol, is legal, and tobacco is legal. So we are completely arbitrary in what we decide is legal and what we decide is illegal. Now, that's to embarrass our national position about this, to take very seriously your own relationship to friends who have been addicted to meth, and I have friends who've been addicted to that. My own cousin died of alcohol 2 weeks ago, so everybody has these issues in their own lives, and they must be taken super seriously. I take the issue of addiction as serious as a heart attack. It is a leading national epidemic we have, all the more reason that we need a treatment system for it. But instead, we are letting politicians and their friends in business profit from treating it wrongly as a crime. Now, the interesting thing is, what does it cry out for? And this is where it gets, in my view, very clear, very quick, and very poignant. We learned in Newtown, of course, Newtown in the tragedy was going to create this shameful extremist shrill debate about gun violence, where everything is about shouting and nobody's saying textured real things about what this means to the people on the ground. But let's put the gun debate aside because it's volatile and kind of dangerous to get lost in. What Newtown said to me most loudly was that it underscored our woeful lack of a mental health system in this mm-hmm. country. When you hear embarrassing politicians who say that we should stop such a threat by having armed teachers or people armed at the school door, mm-hmm. these people should be laughed out of public office until they never resurface. Because obviously that is that is far too little too late, and it's woeful unpreparedness in the thinking. Now, what's interesting, though, is that the drug war is a corollary of this, because if we had a mental health system, it would include in it a massive commitment to the drug treatment, which is part of mental health services. So the fact that we have the unchecked levels of addiction in this country that we have, and the growing phenomenon of implosive violence that we have, these are related issues, and both would be addressed deeply by the country shifting gears to seriously recognize our lack of mental health service in this country and address it. You can almost picture it inside a police car. This is where it's almost most poignant for me to think of it. You have police officers, as I traveled with in my film, and you'll see them in the film tonight, who sit in the front seat of their patrol car, and what they do all day, all night, is look out their driver's side window to see if anyone is passing by that they can jack up against the side of a liquor store, and they can score a petty drug arrest on that nonviolent person. And each of the ones they get add up to more overtime and more incentives that cops get to be privy to. And what does that do? It totally warps that cops spend most of their time now trying to rack up petty drug arrests rather than solving serious crimes. So here's this officer who's racking up 40, 50, 60 of these arrests out his driver's side window. Meanwhile, out the passenger side window, somebody may be walking by who's mentally unstable, has ill intent, and is about to go manifest a serious threat to public safety, but the officer's too busy with the going rate of what it is that's paying his salary, because we have warped the system so terribly that well-meaning officers are finding that the dominant thing they do with their time is to harass the nonviolent rather than the much more sticky, much less incentivized business of solving serious crime. Mm.
And also to harass, even though it's supposed to be illegal to profile people for drug use, there was a lot of that going on in your film.
Yes, and many of the officers I talk to are really very open about it, and they'll say to me, like, I'm crazy. Of course we profile. Are you joking? Anyone who tells you we don't profile would be lying to you. That's built into the job.
And getting back, before we go back to phone calls, and we have to pause for a moment, why do you think, you must have thought about this a lot during the film, why do we have so many people who are addicted? Are people's lives that painful, or what is it?
I have some strong feelings on that. Do you want to talk about that now?
Well, just for a moment, if you don't mind.
I think America has a crisis of meaning. I think this is a democracy that's been hijacked by modern-day capitalism. And I think people don't feel about this country the way they feel when they watch Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life.
Mm.
And I think they think it's not such a wonderful life. It isn't quite what they were promised. The ideals of the Constitution that we hold very, very dear, the ideas this country was built on, are basically under siege 24 hours a day. And in the process of that, big business has so carried away the welfare of this country that people don't have the community structures that restore confidence and belief. I live in the state of Vermont. It's one of the greatest places in the world because it feels like old America, because you have small towns with a town center. It's not just kids, you know, getting stoned and doing skateboards outside of a Sam's Club. It's actually a town with a place with a lawn and a place where they can throw a frisbee and all those good things that are sort of part of the American dream. I think the American dream has been shattered for a lot of people who, some people never even saw it at all, like black Americans who went from slavery into five other kinds of slavery by another name leading to the present. And now poor whites who are now feeling the exact same kind of meaninglessness. David Simon, who created The Wire, you know, he's in the film, and he says this incredible thing at one point where he says, look, he says, you know, we like to tell ourselves all kinds of lies, but at the end of the day, work gives people meaning. For a lot of us, if
yes,
we don't have
does.
Serious work, we lose a sense of identity as people. When you look at the unemployment rates in the communities that also are major drug-using communities, of course it's the case that people are trying to self-medicate because a drug addict knows what they have to do in the morning. They got to get up and get $10. At least it's meaning.
Eugene Jarecki is our guest. His film, his latest film, The House I Live In, will be broadcast tonight on PBS, 9 o'clock, Wisconsin Public Television, 10 o'clock for those of you in Milwaukee on Milwaukee Public Television. And it's, it's well worth seeing. It's very, very well done, and some extremely important questions are asked. He's an award-winning filmmaker, and We are delighted to have him with us the day that this film will be shown nationally. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The House I Live In, highly recommended viewing tonight on PBS. And Eugene is our guest, the director, the writer of the film. He's done a number of other very important films, and this one's well worth seeing. Back to phone calls. We have a few more minutes for them. Lynn in Eau Claire, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen and Eugene. I myself and people like me who suffer from chronic pain have been kind of victims on the periphery of the drug war. We are denied access to narcotics, even if we have no history of addiction. We are treated as pariahs when we show up in the ER suffering from pain, and often misdiagnosed because the powers that be are concerned about the DEA, and they overlook the underlying issue. And I might add that both of my brothers died from the abuse of the number one accessible drug in America, which was alcohol.
Eugene.
Well, you know, I think generally speaking, part of the movement for legalizing drugs in this country is to see the government take a responsible public health position. That's the key issue here. So very often if people ask me, what should we do? Do we legalize? Well, legalization scares people because what it says is with serious drugs like the other caller asked about with methamphetamine or whatever, it's as if the government would just step back and sort of hope for the best that these very serious drugs, you know, wouldn't have a destructive impact. Of course, that's irresponsible. The government, as in Portugal, needs to retain a very serious public health commitment here and simply switch its behavior from punitive to caring, to compassion and science-based. It's not that the government is supposed to be able to say, great, now that we're an all-or-nothing thing. Either you have us draconian or you don't have us at all. No, the government should tax and regulate. Well, in the process of doing that, of course, any time you would introduce science into the consideration of this and you'd have medicine and compassionate thinking running the show, people like the caller who have serious health issues for which they need palliative care and palliative drug use would, of course, be a natural and fundamental part of that new commitment. Right now, she's just finding herself by the roadside as this, you know, incredible machinery of war powers on and could actually care less what happens to her. It's a system that's as uncaring toward her as it is to those it directly targets.
Thanks, Lynn. Chris in Saratoga, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. I would like your guest to comment on the effects of our drug policy on pre-employment applications and conditions of employment.
If I understand what you mean, I mean, the major thing that happens all across this country is that young people find themselves getting a mark on their record at 13, 14 years of age that they can never lose. And for the rest of their lives, they have to fill out a job application and check that box that says they've been convicted or arrested of a crime. And it makes their job prospects far smaller, far dimmer. And what then happens is it becomes far more likely that they end up in the underground economies of drug selling, which means they also end up in the far more likely situation of drug using, because the two do seem to go hand in glove. When you're around something, you know, people who bake a lot get fat. People who make ice cream get a little chubby. People who deal in drugs all day do find that they sample the stuff, and then you get into a really disastrous, vicious cycle. So generally speaking, young people are the people we target most, and there's a movement across the country you can Google to see what's happening in your state called Ban the Box. And Ban the Box means ban the corporations from being able to use that box on employment applications. It would get rid of the box or put it far deeper in an employment application so people are not just judged by that on the cover page, but that they would have to interview someone. They can still do a background check after that, and that they might find out that the person had served time or had a crime, but they've already met the person and made them not just a statistic or a checked box.
Eugene, obviously people want to know more here. What's the website you recommend?
My own website is called The House I Live In, which is the title of the film, thehouseilivein.org. The movie shows tonight at 10 p.m. on PBS, and I think you can check listings for other parts of the country just to make sure it's the right time. And it'll show tonight, and in keeping with that, we'd love people to go to the website. You can also follow us at Drug War Movie on Twitter, or go find us on Facebook at The House I Live In, and really get involved. We have an ongoing conversation. We involve people quite heavily, and we always service people if they want to have a screening in their area or bring it to their school or church or prison.
Great.
You know, we do a lot of that.
All right. Well, you're a real force. Thank you so much for being with us. I enjoyed the hour
thank
immensely.
Thank you very much for having me.
Eugene Jarecki, director and writer of The House I Live In. It's at 9 o'clock tonight on Wisconsin Public Television, 10 o'clock on Milwaukee Public Television. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this highly interesting program and Katie Mattson for on-air production in Milwaukee. Just a reminder to you, because the deadline's coming up, I'm going to be speaking at the Western Wisconsin Listener's Dinner. It's Monday, 2 weeks from now, huh? April 22nd at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson, Wisconsin. 5 o'clock, we'll have a social hour. 6 o'clock, a dinner buffet and a presentation. $25 per person. Not bad. Call Eau Claire for more information. 800-228-5615.